And I didn't think I was going to make it here. Between my brother and the committee, my brother was on the committee before, so they decided that I was going to end up being the speaker, and they thought my brother would tell me, and so nobody called me and asked me, and it got to be about a month beforehand, and my brother said, you know, you're speaking up there at Council Bluffs, and I said, well, nobody called me or anything, so I had to call up here and see if I was on the flyer, and then luckily my other brother lived up here, and he said, yeah, you're on the flyer, you speak at 3:00, and I said, okay, well, I'll ask for it off, so luckily, thanks. Things work out, but I should have known my family still screws things up, you know. But I'm your budget speaker. I'm the person that's keeping the conference within its budget. It's funny. Ever since I started working for an airline, people found out I could fly for free. I've never been so popular before that. They wouldn't even ask me to speak at my home group, you know. I hate to disappoint some of you, but I'm from right here. I'm from Council Bluffs, Iowa. I grew up here. I haven't been here in about 18 years, but I'm from Council Bluffs, Iowa. And a lot has changed since I've been here. It was a little bit more pure back when I was here. We didn't have all these casinos and go-go girls and everything back then. As a matter of fact, I was at my home group last Thursday, and this guy asked me, he says, so what are you doing this weekend? And I said, well, I'm going to Council Bluffs, Iowa to speak. And he says, well, that's on the east side of town, or the east side of the state, isn't it? And I said, no, it's on the west side. He says, oh, I know that town. He says, that's the casinos, the adult bookstores, and the go-go girls. But I was rooting for you guys. I told him they just put in a new soybean processing plant here, you know. I wanted him to... I had to protect the dignity of this town, you know. But I grew up here, and I grew up on the other side of town, an alcoholic home. It was an alcoholic, crazy home, and I'd call it dysfunctional, but I thought we did pretty good considering the circumstances, I have some of my family members are here, the ones that scarred me. I'm not kidding, no. But I like to say that it's actually hard to figure out who scarred who, you know. We always kind of point at each other. I don't think anybody knew what was going on. I don't think my parents knew what was going on, and I certainly didn't know how to be a good son, that's for sure. I remember that living in an alcoholic home wasn't all bad. I mean, I didn't know any different. The best thing I could tell you is that my family didn't look any different than any other family in that neighborhood. I think I grew up in an alcoholic neighborhood. I remember the people off to the left, as they'd beat their kids in the front yard, and the guy across the street would expose himself, and the guy off to the right would beat his wife out front. And we fit right in. I remember some Christians moved in once, and we thought they were weird, so we'd tomato their house and egg their house, and they only made it about a couple of years there. But I never really thought anything was different, and I didn't think I really stood out until I started going to school. When I started going to school, I knew there was something different for me than the other kids, because when I went there, you know, I never got positive attention. I found that negative attention was the easiest attention to get, and I was willing to take any kind of attention I could get. And remember, I'd always start out all the way through grade school. I'd start out, I'd show up the first day, and the teachers would think I was funny and cute with my little smart-alecky attitude. And after about 3 days of it, they'd just give me this scornful look for the rest of the year, and I wasn't very welcome in that classroom. And I remember those teachers, they tried everything to help me. Those teachers just... Man, they would take me out in the hall. I remember, this was just in the third grade, this teacher took me out in the hall, and she looked at me and she said, Scott, she said, I don't know what I'm going to do with you. She says, you're not even going to make it through school with that kind of attitude. And I just thought, these old people, they just leave me alone. Everything would be okay. Because, you know, I always had a plan. Before I took any action, I always had a plan. I always thought it through in my head, and I knew what the end result was going to be, and it never worked out. I thought, well, I'll just say this, and everything will work out okay. And it never worked like that. I always ended up in trouble. I remember one teacher told me, she said, Scott, she says, you can do whatever you want. She said, you just got to be willing to pay the consequences of your actions. And I said, no, I said, I'm not going to do that. I wasn't willing to do that. But I always wondered, I thought, you know, when is my life going to get better? When are things going to change? Because all I really wanted, I just wanted to have some friends. I wanted to be happy. You know, I wasn't asking too much. And that alcoholic home, you know, I just remember some of the occasions. My family was a family that drank together. I remember going to wedding receptions with my family, and everybody would drink, you know, and I started drinking at a young age, but I never really got drunk. I mean, I just drank, acted a little silly and went home, you know, and I never really had the opportunity to do any serious drinking at a young age. And I remember going to wedding receptions, and my dad would be too drunk to drive home, and he'd throw the keys to my brother, and my brother wasn't any better off than my dad, and I was a little nervous about my brother driving home, and a lot of exciting things happened in that home. I remember coming downstairs and my dad, I don't know what he did, but he was gluing all this furniture back together that he just bought my mom a few weeks ago, and he wasn't talking to anybody, my mom wasn't talking to anybody, and I remember he was just looking down, gluing furniture together, and I thought, you know, I remember saying, I'll never do the things my dad did. I'll never be like my dad. And I just thought, I'm gonna be a much better person than that. I'm not gonna do those things. I guess eventually what happened was I had an opportunity to drink. I had an opportunity to get drunk, and some of my brother's friends came up to me at a city park here in Council Bluffs, and they said, Scott, they said, you want to do some drinking? And I was 12 years old, and I said, yeah. And they said, well, give us some money. And I graciously reached in my pocket and gave him $2 I stole from my brother that day, because that's how things worked in my home. They went out, they bought me a six-pack of Miller beer. When they came back, I remember I drank as much as I could, as fast as I could. And when it went down, I knew why everybody drank. Because when it went down, I felt good. I felt good, and I felt indestructible. And I remember I was in the city park, and there were some girls there, and they were a grade older than me. They were 13 years old, and I was 12 years old. And the reason I remember that is because the 13-year-olds had breasts, and the 12-year-olds didn't. I got into the illusion that I was a stallion. You know, when I was drinking, I went up and I talked to those girls, and all I remember is they laughed. They were probably laughing at me, but I thought they were laughing at what I was saying. I like the effect. I like what alcohol did. And that night, some guys were sitting around smoking cigarettes, and I sat in that circle with those guys, and I was smoking cigarettes with those guys, and I thought, man, I'm finally one of the guys, you know. Later on, I found out that was marijuana, and I liked the effect of that, too. But a couple of those guys are in prison today that I was sitting there smoking cigarettes with. But I remember I was supposed to be home when the streetlights were on that night. And the streetlights had been going for a long time when I showed up at my mom's front door with my grass-stained jeans, because I had to crawl across the park. I went to open the door, and my mom had already been driving around looking for me, and she was waiting for me, and she popped the door open, and she looked at me, and she said, Scott, you're drunk. And I said, yeah, but Mom, I only had a couple, because I... My dad would always say that. I figured it worked for me, you know. And what happened was, I came inside, and she started lecturing me, and she says, you're going to wait till your dad gets home. My dad was a disciplinarian in the family, and my mom would keep a list all day of all the things we had done wrong. And when my dad came home, it was time to pay the piper. Normally I was afraid. I was afraid when my dad came home. I didn't look forward to seeing my dad getting off work and coming home. This night I didn't care. My dad was, he's probably 6'3", 230 pounds. And I was like, bring him on, you know, I didn't care. Because I was feeling good that night. And I remember my dad got home, and I tried to take him, and it didn't work very well. I remember, things got a little out of hand, all I remember was waking up the next morning. And I remember you always had a treatment in my family based on what you'd done. And usually if you're out drinking, my dad would find, he was bound to determine he was going to straighten you out. And my treatment that day was I had to go out and pull the weeds out of this retaining wall and pull the weeds in the yard. And it was like 85, 90 degrees out and high humidity. And I would puke a little bit and pull some weeds. And I'd puke a little bit and pull some weeds. He had all these treatments. And the other one was the Kirby treatment. You had to vacuum all the rooms in the house twice, or you had to wash and wax all the cars twice. He was just bound determined that he was going to make us men. I didn't care. I didn't care. I was deathly ill that day. I didn't say, that's it, I'm never going to drink again. I couldn't wait to drink again. I didn't care about all the trouble I'd got in the night before. I remember some of the neighbor kids, their parents told them not to hang out with me because I was a bad influence on them. And I thought, geez, how did this happen, you know? I thought, their kids are doing drugs, and they don't want to hang out with me just because I'm drinking a little bit. I made up my mind from that point on I was going to drink as much as I could, as often as I could. And due to my age, it wasn't very much, and it wasn't very often. And I proceeded to go to wedding receptions. I'd go with my mom. She probably thought I was just a great son. But I'd go with my mom to these sit through the wedding. I'd dress up in a scratchy outfit, just like going to church. And I'd sit through I didn't even know the people who were getting married, but I'd sit there through that and just wait for the reception. And every now and then I'd even bring a friend and tell them how great it was to go to these receptions. And I'd go to the reception and I'd sit down and I'd drink whatever was available and I'd go in the bathroom, I'd take a look in the mirror, and if I didn't look okay, I'd go back out and I'd drink some more until I started to look okay. And once I felt okay, I'd go back out there and I'd ask the girls to dance and I'd have the time of my life. And it got to a point where I started, when I turned like 15 years old, I started hanging out with guys that were older than me and they had driver's license and they knew people who could buy beer and eventually what happened was I'd sit there on school on Monday morning and I'd plan the whole week out and I'd say, okay, well on Friday night we'll plan who's going to get the beer, where we're going to go, who's going to drive the car and get everything all straightened out and Friday night would roll around and our whole objective was on Friday night we were going to go out and get drunk and go out and either get a girl or get in a fight. You know, that was our objective. And unfortunately, all that happened to me was I just got beat up a lot. You know, I never really did. I never conquered any 15 or 16 year old girls. And at first I started out, I was having a lot of fun. I mean, I was having the time of my life. And I'd wake up the next morning and it got to the point where I couldn't remember what happened the night before. And I'd call my friends and I'd say, well, did it look like I was having fun or did I embarrass myself? And they say, oh no, it just looked like you were having a good time. And that's how it started out. And I got a $10 a week allowance, so that didn't go very far. I can only afford a six pack on Friday night, a six pack on Saturday night. And then on Monday morning, I'd go steal my lunch money from my dad because he was sleeping. He worked nights. And this went on for a while. And eventually it got to a point where I was calling my friends and they weren't telling me it looked like I was just having fun anymore. I mean, they were telling me that I embarrassed myself and I had embarrassed them. And it got to a point where I started waking up in the morning and I would say, that's it. This is the last time. I'm never going to drink again. I found out that I'd embarrassed myself, my friends, this is the last time. And the pain would go away and then Saturday night would roll around and I'd say, well, it wasn't that bad. And I'd go out Saturday night and start all over again. And I had a strict curfew. I mean, my parents really tried to teach me right from wrong. I'd be home by midnight and I knew I had to be home by midnight. So I'd go out and I'd drink as fast as I could. And the only problem I really had with drinking is I just couldn't get it down fast enough. For some reason, when I drank that Miller beer, it foamed up and it had a tendency to come out through my nose and my mouth and it'd get all over me. But eventually, some bad things happened in my family. My mom started going Al-Anon. I think after my dad went in the psych ward, my mom went in the psych ward. After they did that a few times, my mom said, the heck with it, and she went to Al-Anon. What happened was, I mean, I was really having a good time yet. I was still having the time of my life. My mom was going to these Al-Anon meetings. I remember she came back. They had this family intervention on my brother. You know, they were supposed to tell my brother I was supposed to go there and tell my brother how his drinking affected me, but I didn't go because my brother was my idol. I wanted to drink and do all the things he did. I mean, he'd come home with his face all beat in and his truck all demolished. And I wanted to do all those things, you know. I wanted to do all the fun things he did. But they had this intervention on my brother. And next thing I know, my brother's going off to treatment. So then I was getting a little nervous at that time. And then pretty soon it was my dad's turn, you know. My dad, they had this family intervention on my father. In the 80s, interventions were a big deal. My dad, they gave my dad a choice, either, you know, quit drinking or my mom wanted a divorce. And my dad, there was no way my dad was going to quit drinking. He wasn't going to quit drinking for anything. He wasn't an alcoholic, and all the people there were crazy, and he called the police and tried to kick him out, and the police tried to tell him that they were right, you know, and it got a little out of hand. And I really wanted to go to that intervention and tell my dad I was drinking affected me, because it had. It affected me my whole life, and I knew it. But while he was in the psych ward, I was drinking all his past Blue Ridge ribbon out of the garage, you know, and I didn't want to have to go face him that day. I was a little too drunk to attend. And like I said, I was still having fun. I mean, because I just turned 16, I got my driver's license, and I started drinking and driving. And I don't know about you, but I love drinking and driving. I didn't have any care or concern for anybody out there at all. To me, drinking and driving was the best video game in the world. And when I drank, you know, I turned into Steve McQueen. I don't know if some of you know who he is, but I really thought I was a good driver. I remember, actually I was in Bellevue, hopefully it wasn't your mailboxes, but 1 week I was in Bellevue and when I was drunk I just didn't care about anything. Everything was okay and I just started taking out mailboxes all the way through Bellevue and I was laughing, having the time of my life, and I sobered up the next day and my dad came up and he woke me up and he said, "Scott," he says, "you smashed your pickup up." He says, "What'd you do?" And I said, "Well, I turned a corner, the steering wheel locked, and I ran into some mailboxes, you know." I said, "The steering doesn't work. I told you it doesn't work. If we fixed it, I wouldn't have this problem, you know." And he says, "Were you drinking?" I said, "No, I wasn't drinking." And he said, "Okay," and he left. He just believed me. And when he left, man, I thought, man, that's it. This is the last time. I am not going to drink again. And 1 week later, I went out with a friend of mine. And, of course, all the pain had wore off. And I went and picked him up, and we started drinking. And luckily, I had enough money I could drink more than my usual six-pack. And I just started drinking as much as I could. And this guy got upset. He says, "Scott," he says, "take me home." He says, "You're an alcoholic, man." He says, "I don't want any part of you." But luckily, there was somebody next door that I could just pick another friend up, somebody who wanted to go out and do some drinking. And I remember that night, I wrapped that pickup truck around the telephone pole. And I thought, to get out of trouble, I'll go see my uncle who's in AA. And so I went out there and got him up about 1 o'clock in the morning. And I'm sure he wasn't too happy to see me, but I was drunk, you know. And I thought, well, if I can talk to him, I can tell my parents. I talked to my uncle in AA, and you know, they'll think that everything's okay, you know, that it was okay. It wasn't that big a deal. I'm trying to straighten myself out. And didn't quite work out that way. My uncle just gave me some coffee, talked about AA a little bit, and sent me on my way. I got home and, man, I knew I was in trouble, and I knew I had a problem, but I didn't think my problem was drinking. I really didn't think so. My dad, you know, he said, "Well, you know, you're going to pay for it, you know," and he gave me the punishment, and I didn't really get it that bad. I think my parents were always tried to take good care of me, you know, and they wanted the best for me, but I said, "That's it. I'm never going to drink again. This is the last time, and I mean it." But luckily what happened was my parents were going through a divorce, and I had heard a rumor that I was going to end up going to a treatment center. I didn't want any part of that. And once I heard it, I remember all I had was $10 in my pocket, and I had an old Ford pickup, and that would get me about 50 miles out of town probably if I was lucky. But I had a moped in the garage, and I thought, I can get pretty far on $10. I packed it up, and I traveled... I left Council Bluffs and I ended up in Battle Lake, Minnesota, 450 miles from here. It took me 2 12-hour days to get there, but I wasn't going to treatment. I remember I went 27, but when a semi passed me on the highway, I could get it up to about 32. But that didn't last long. I remember my mom called up there and told these people that I was staying with that if I didn't come back home, that she was going to call the police up there and they were going to come get me and bring me back. So I ended up coming back here and I didn't get along with anybody in my family, and life was getting pretty crazy and I didn't know what to do. One day I overreacted at my mother's house and I destroyed that same living room, and I was sober and I was crazy, and I destroyed that same living room that my dad had destroyed years before. My brother and I got in a big fight, and it wasn't a big fight. He just beat the tar out of me. He's just trying to restrain me, I guess. I remember I was losing and I didn't know what to do. And my mom looked at me and she said, "Scott," she says, "I love you, but I don't know what to do." She said, "You either go to this treatment center for alcoholism or don't come back home." And I thought, man, I'm a loser, because I didn't have a friend in the world. I didn't have anybody and I didn't know what to do. And she says, "Well, just go for an evaluation." And I thought that was, you go up and take a test for an hour and you get to come back home. And so I went to this treatment center, and I got up there, and they started talking about me getting in pajamas, and it was a week evaluation, and they started talking about me doing all this stuff that I didn't want to do, but I really didn't have a choice. I didn't have any place to go. I remember during that first week, I had to go see a psychiatrist, and I thought I was crazy. I mean, because I had glass, and my neck was all cut up, my hands were all cut up, I thought, when I see this psychiatrist, they'll just take me and transfer me from my alcoholism ward over the psych ward and everything will be okay. You know, that's like a step up, I figured. And at least you can drink, you know. Because I was too young to be an alcoholic. But I ended up seeing the psychiatrist that week, and the psychiatrist gave me all these tests and everything. And I remember this guy Sam that I was in treatment with, Sam took a bunch of tests, and the psychiatrist came back and said he was a genius, you know, and I thought, maybe that's what it is. I thought, maybe I'm just a little smart for my own good, you know, but that wasn't it. The psychiatrist just told me I was an alcoholic. He came back, and I'd taken all these tests, and he says, Scott, he says, the only thing I can see is that you're an alcoholic. And I had a counselor, and the counselor up there said, Scott, I think you're an alcoholic. And there was a medical doctor up there, and he said, Scott, he says, I think you're an alcoholic. And you know what? I didn't care what anybody said. I was not going to quit drinking. I was not going to quit drinking because drinking, when I started drinking, my life took off. That's when life began. That's what made me feel good. And I went through the little group therapy sessions. I was good at yelling people. I mean, I could play the game. I figured I'd do whatever I had to do to get out of that treatment center. And my mom was real serious about me sobering up. Not only do I go through a month of inpatient, I had to go through 2 months of outpatient treatment. And I thought, well, I won't drink while I'm in treatment because, you know, my mom's paying for all this. I might as well give it a shot. And when I got out of treatment, I remember I had to go to the dentist. So the dentist gave me some pills. I had a really good dentist at the time. He gave me these little volume pills because I had my wisdom teeth pulled. And it said right on the side, do not take with alcohol. And I knew what that meant because my brother used to take pills, and he told me what it meant. He said, the deal is if it says don't take it with alcohol, the reason they say that is because it'll enhance the effect. It'll make it a lot better than it normally is. And so I took those pills, and I drank some whiskey, and I went to the dentist, and he sat me in the chair, gave me some gas, and he could have pulled them off for all I cared. I didn't feel guilty, remorseful. I mean, I felt satisfied after I did that. I remember I thought, well, you know, I thought my mom paid for all this treatment. The least I could do is go to an AA meeting. And I went to my first AA meeting here in Council Bluffs, Iowa, downtown Council Bluffs. And I remember I walked in the place, and I looked around, and the walls were white at one time, but they were kind of a smoky white now. And the carpet was coffee stained, and the furniture looked like the type of furniture that you leave on the curb for the Salvation Army, you know. And I walked in this place, and there was a bunch of old guys sitting around smoking cigarettes, drinking coffee. Man, this just looked like the place you went after you had all the fun you could possibly stand in life, you know? It was like, when I looked at Alcoholics Anonymous, it was like this was your punishment for having so much fun, you know? I sat down with these guys, and I was 16 years old, and they went around the table, and they proceeded to tell me how lucky I was that I sobered up at 16 years of age. And I didn't want to sober up. And the first guy said he had been to prison, you know, and the hardest time I ever did was in school suspension. You know, they went on to the next guy, and he had lost his wife and his kids, and I just got a girlfriend, you know. I thought that was enough, but I mean, it just went on and on. And one guy said he did 15, 20 years of hard drinking. And I don't have to go through that 15, 20 years of hard drinking that he went through. And by the time those guys were done talking, I wanted 15, 20 years of hard drinking. I wanted to do everything those guys had done. You know, I didn't want to quit. I don't want to be some pansy that sobered up in AA. You know, I wanted to go out there and live life and do what they'd done. There was one guy in that room, and I don't remember his name, but I remember this guy told me, he says, Scott, he says, if you don't think you're alcoholic, he says, try to control it. Try to just have one. And I got to thinking, I thought, that's a good idea, because I never ever tried to control it. I always drank as much as I could, as fast as I could. I never tried to control my intake of liquor. So I left that AA meeting. I thought it was a great thing that I had heard. And I went to a party that night, got myself a bottle of Miller beer, and I was going to drink just one. I was going to prove that I wasn't an alcoholic. I opened up that bottle, and I drank it. Good, they were done. There's one guy in that room, and I don't remember his name, but I remember this guy told me, he says, Scott, he says, if you don't think you're alcoholic, he says, try to control it. Try to just have one. And I got to thinking, I thought, that's a good idea, because I never ever tried to control it. I always drank as much as I could, as fast as I could. I never tried to control my intake of liquor. So I left that AA meeting. I thought it was a great thing that I had heard. And I went to a party that night, got myself a bottle of Miller beer, and I was going to drink just one. I was going to prove that I wasn't an alcoholic. I opened up that bottle, and I drank it down, and I got to thinking, you know, I thought, you know, that's stupid. Why would anybody just drink one? I didn't like the taste, you know. I just drank for the effect, and I looked around. Everybody's having fun, and I'm just sitting there. The only thing I really remember that night is one time I remember driving fast, and the next minute I was on the front porch on the same, grabbing for the same door, and my mother's there again, and she said, Scott, you're drunk. She said, what are you going to do? And I wasn't stupid. I said, I'm going to treatment. You know, I knew how to get out of trouble. Man, I tell you, I woke up the next morning in that treatment center, and I thought, man, I'm an alcoholic. You know, I'm a little slow, but I thought, man, I'm an alcoholic. I didn't doubt it at all. And I ended up going through treatment again, and I knew all the counselors by first name, so it was like, you know, it wasn't really a big deal. And I got out of treatment, and they said I should try something different. They said I should go to this halfway house for alcoholism, and I went to this halfway house, and I don't quite get it. I don't know what I was halfway to, but I remember they'd bring guys to the front door and unhandcuff them and let them in, you know, and kept me on my toes. But when I was in that halfway house, they made me go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. You had to go to, I think it was 3 AA meetings a week. And I don't know about you, but I did not like going to meetings. I did not want to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And after my time was up out of that treatment center, I remember I went to a few meetings, but I'd always pick these meetings where people are sitting around whining and complaining about their problems, and then I'd whine and complain about my problems. We'd all feel bad. We'd go home and we'd all have the same problems. You know, nothing really changed. But after a while, I got sick of those meetings because I'd go home and I'd be like, man, I got enough of my own problems. I'm not going to go there and listen to their problems. I thought, somebody told me about a meeting in Bellevue, and I thought, well, I'll go to this Bellevue meeting and see what it's about, you know. And I went down there, and I walked in the place, and everybody's all fired up, and they were dressed nice. And I looked out in the parking lot. They had nice cars, and I remember there was a good speaker that night, and it was funny. It was entertaining, and I got to thinking on the way home. I thought, you know what? I know what this is about. I thought, it's about money. I thought, if I had all the money those people had, I thought, I'd go to A, and I'd be happy too, you know. So I thought, you know what? I'll just do it on my own. I'll just stop drinking on my own and do it my way, you know, and that's what I had proceeded to do. I remember the first year and a half of my sobriety, I went through 5 jobs. I remember eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for months because I couldn't manage my money. I was suffering from the disease of alcoholism, and I wasn't even drinking. After a year and a half, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to do. I was crying myself to sleep at night. I was depressed. And I'd have killed myself, but I figured I'd be lucky to have my mom at my funeral. You know, who would care? That's what I thought. Nobody would really care. Man, I was just at the jumping off point because I thought, you know, it's a shame. I thought, AA works for you, but it doesn't work for me. Because I'd tried it. I really thought I had tried it, you know. And I remember I asked somebody to sponsor me. I never called them again. And then around a year of sobriety, I asked some guy to sponsor me because I saw if you want a year of coin, you got to have a sponsor. So I got a sponsor. He gave me this coin. And, you know, I'm ready to kill myself, but I was really happy that I had a coin. But I got to a point where I just didn't know what to do. Luckily for me, what happened was this brother of mine was going to come back to visit. We were never fond of my brother coming back to visit at all. I mean, he would come home, he'd have cow manure on his clothes, and he smelled bad, and he wasn't fun to be around. This time he came back, and I went over to see him, and when he walked in the door, there was something different about him. I just remember he was clean cut. He had a haircut. He was brushing his teeth. He was showering, and he was wearing decent clothes, you know. And that was the first thing I noticed. And then he started talking, and I thought, man, he's polite to me. He's polite to my mother. I thought, what got into him? He wanted to go out jogging. So I remember I went out jogging with him. I don't know when he got on this jogging kick, but I went out jogging with him. And he started telling me about, you know, how for the past 3 months, he says, I've been going to regular meetings. I got a sponsor. He says, I'm not drinking. He says, man, my life's getting better. He started talking. He said, man, I'm going to go to college. He says, we're running marathons. He was just giving me the full bore. And when he told me he was dating, that's what sold me. I thought, man, he's dating, you know. I thought, if he can get a date, I could get a date. And I thought, if AA works for him, it'll work for me too, because I knew what a loser my brother was, you know. He was my idol, you know. What he did was he went back up to Moorhead, Minnesota, and he called me down there, and he says, Scott, he says, I got you a job up here. He says, you can move up whenever you want. And at the time, I didn't really have a lot going on. I remember this girl said I could move to Kansas, someplace down in Kansas, and fill vending machines for a living. It was either that or go to Minnesota. So I went to Minnesota, and all I had was a box of clothes and an old motorcycle, and I didn't have a friend in the world. And I drove up to Moorhead, Minnesota. When I got there, I remember a bunch of guys in AA were sitting around. It was like they had planned it, and I found out later on they did. A bunch of the guys in AA were sitting around, and my brother came up to me, and he says, oh, by the way, he says, the job didn't work out. I didn't have a dime to my name. I had a motorcycle that didn't even have any gas. I couldn't even get back. And these guys in AA said, Scott, they said, you can live with us, but if you're going to live with us, you got to go to the meetings when we go to the meetings. And I said, okay, you know, like I had a choice. And I remember they put a mattress on the kitchen floor and I put my clothes in the cupboards. So I started going to regular meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember the first week I was there, this guy used to call me every night, or call me every morning, and his name was Louie. And he'd call me bright and early in the morning and say, Scott, you weren't sleeping, were you? And I'd be like, oh, no, of course I was sleeping, but I'd say, oh, no. And he says, all right, we'll put some coffee on. And he says, I'm coming over. Louie was, he was pretty forceful, you know. He'd come over and he'd start talking to me about Alcoholics Anonymous at like 9 o'clock in the morning. And he'd go jogging and he'd still be talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And luckily for me, the guys would come home from work about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and then Louie would quit talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. But mostly go out jogging, and then we'd go to the meeting, and after the meeting we'd go out for coffee and we'd talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. We went out for coffee. These guys were so patient and tolerant, because I'd sit there and I'd tell them how smart I was, and man, I had a GED and I didn't even know what it stood for, you know, and these guys knew that, you know, and they started talking about money and they had to pay for my coffee and my cookies on the way out, you know, but I'd tell them about money. I knew everything about money. I remember they'd start talking about women, and I knew everything about women. I think I'd had one girlfriend my whole life, and she was crazy, you know, these guys just put up with me, a lot of love, patience, and tolerance, and no matter what I said, they just accepted me. After a week, I remember I couldn't take it anymore. I couldn't take being around my sponsor anymore. I had to get a job just so I wouldn't have to spend the whole day hanging out with Louie, listening to him share with me about Alcoholics Anonymous. Remember the first weekend that I was there, I went to an AA conference with this gentleman right back here. I remember he had been sober 30-something years in sobriety. And I remember sitting in the back of his van, and we're driving to this AA conference, and he was going to be the speaker. And I'm sitting back there popping his gourmet chocolates, drinking his coffee. And I'm thinking, these other guys are asking questions and about AA. And I'm thinking, what does this old guy know about living life, you know? I didn't even have any money, you know. The chocolates were like my meal, you know. I had nothing going on, but I was sure willing to criticize him. We went to that conference, and I remember I hung out with the guys that weekend, and I had a good time. This guy that the sponsor that I had, Louie started dragging me through the steps. I didn't want to do the steps. I didn't want to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember telling him, I said, Louie, I said, I don't like going to meetings. He says, Scott, he says, that's all right. He says, you don't have to like the meetings. He says, but if you want your life to change, you have to go to the meetings. And I could accept that. I thought, that's all right. I didn't want to do the steps. And I remember thinking the first three steps for me took place in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, hearing people share what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'd hear him share what it used to be like, and I'd think, well, I did all those things. There were some things that I didn't do, but I remember thinking, I did all those things. I'm an alcoholic. My life's unmanageable. And they talk about what happened and what it's like now. And I just came to the conclusion, I thought, if it works for them, maybe it can work for me. So I decided that I'd do the things that they did, and I became willing to turn my will and my life over to the fair care of God as I understood it. But the only God I understood was Louie, because he told me what to do, you know. I remember Louie told me, he says, Scott, he says, you need to start on your fourth step. And I said, okay, well, I'll get going on it. And I remember a week later, he says, Scott, are you done with your fourth step yet? And I said, no, not yet. Actually, I hadn't even started. And he said, you better hurry. He says, because we're going to do your fifth step next Wednesday. So I went home and I started doing my fourth step, because I was afraid of Louie. I was a coward, you know. I didn't want to get chewed out over my fourth step. So I went home and I did my fourth step. I went to do my fifth step, and I sat with him in Burger King, and he drank coffee and read the newspaper. That's how Louie was. And I started to do my fifth step. I started to tell this guy things about me that I didn't want to tell anybody. People talked about getting this warm, glowing feeling out of doing the fifth step. It was some kind of spiritual awakening. Man, when I did the fifth step, I looked at this paper, and I thought, man, I had been a loser my whole life. I've justified and rationalized everything. I've just been a parasite of society. I've never done anything for anybody. With the disgust I felt after doing my fifth step, I was ready to go on to do the rest of the steps. I got to the eighth and ninth step, and the ninth step was to make amends. And I told him, I said, don't worry, I've already covered that one. That's what I told him. And I said, he says, well, how'd you do that? And I said, well, I already apologized to everybody. And he says, Scott, he says, that's not what an amends is. He says, if you look up the word apology in the dictionary, he says, it means to make an excuse. And he says, we're not to make an excuse. He says, that's if you owe somebody some money and you go and you say you're sorry. He says, they don't care that you're sorry. He says, they want their money back. So he had to teach me how to make amends, and I didn't know how to do it. And he gave me an example. He says, I'll give you an example. He says, you've been a terrible son your whole life. He says, you've never done anything decent for your parents. And he says, what you need to do, he says, you need to learn how to be a good son. And I didn't know what a good son did. You know, I thought all kids just took everything from their parents, you know, and I got scared of my parents. My mom came down to visit me this summer, and she says, it wasn't so much that we were concerned about your well-being. She says, we were concerned that we were responsible for you, you know, we were financially responsible for you, and I understand that now. So he took me through the eighth and ninth step, and the one step that I didn't want to do is the 12th step. Because I always figured the more I do for me, the better off I'll be. I wasn't about to do anything for you whatsoever. And I was just here to absorb as much as I could for me. I'd missed the whole boat at that point. And I remember my sponsor at the time, he says, Scott, he says, you've been around AA, 2 years now? And he says, you really haven't caught on. He says, you refuse to work with newcomers. He says, you won't carry this message to other alcoholics. And he says, you'd probably be better off drinking. He says, because this is a miserable place to be if you aren't going to get involved. And I remember thinking, I thought, you fat, bald-headed idiot. You can't... I only thought it, I didn't say it, but I remember thinking, you can't talk to me that way. And I remember thinking, I'll show you, you know. And I started to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I'd be shaking newcomers' hands before the meeting and inviting them out for coffee after the meeting, and then we'd start going to the treatment center and the VA hospital, and we'd go up, and I probably broke all the rules on the chapter working with others, but I started working with other alcoholics. And I remember one time we went to the VA hospital, and we didn't know they'd made some changes up there, but we went up to where the alcoholism ward was, and we had like 3 or 4 of these guys convinced to go to the AA meeting already, and we'd just been there a short period of time, and we thought we were doing really well that night, because usually it's like pulling teeth. This friend of mine, Brian, he was up talking to the front desk. He came back and he said, Scott, we're on the wrong floor. This is the psych ward, you know. And I thought, no wonder. But I started doing all these things for one reason only, and that was to spite my sponsor. That was to show him, because I just hated that guy. I don't recommend you get a sponsor like that, but it seemed to work okay with me. It doesn't matter, I guess, as long as you have a sponsor. But all I remember is after a short period of time, looking back, and I thought, you know, I'm not thinking about killing myself anymore. See, this doesn't sound, maybe this isn't a miracle to you, but to me, this is a miracle that I'm not thinking about killing myself and I'm not crying myself to sleep anymore. I seem to feel pretty good about myself. I seem to have a little bit of confidence and a little bit of self-worth. I thought this thing's going to work out. Eventually what happened, though, is I had to move away from my home group. I had to move to Minot, North Dakota. My brother and I got jobs with this company, and it was a joke how we even ended up getting the job. We borrowed some clothes from these guys in AA. It was this big company. It was like the 11th largest company in the United States, and my brother and I were going to interview with them, and we borrowed ties and shirts and pants. Nothing fit, but we went in there to interview with this company, and the product they were selling was controversial, and I didn't know what the word controversial meant. This guy asked us, you know, he interviewed us both at the same time since we're brothers. He said, what do you guys think about the controversy? And I didn't know what controversy meant, so I came kind of a blank look, and I thought, well, my big brother, I'll look at him, he'll know what's going on. I looked at my big brother, and he got the same look on his face, you know? I said, what's controversy? And he said, that's what I want to hear, and we both got the job, and I... I spent some 5.5 years with that company, and I remember after a while, and it's funny, after you go to AA and you learn to make commitments, keep commitments, and do what you're supposed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you get to apply that in other areas. I got to apply it in my job. And after a while, they promoted me and paid me more money. And part of my promotion was I had to move away from my home group. I don't know about you, but I was a little worried about that because I was about the best. I was feeling the best I'd ever felt in my life, and I didn't want to ruin it, and I was really insecure. And I remember for the first month, I'd drive back and forth from Minot, North Dakota, down to Moorhead, Minnesota, and I remember I had a different sponsor living in a different town, and my sponsor always told me, he says, Scott, he says, whenever you change jobs or go to different meetings or do, you know, loss of a loved one, he says, all that is a temporary period of uncertainty. He says, even normal people go through that. And he says, the thing is, he says, you live in that town. And he says, what you need to do is you need to stay in that town. You need to work with alcoholics and become an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And,
And I said, but you don't understand. I don't like these meetings here. You know, they complain about their problems. And he says, well, he says, after the meetings, he says, take these guys out for coffee and tell them what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. And he says, if they want what you have, they'll ask you to sponsor. And so I started doing that after the meetings. And lo and behold, after a while, a few guys stuck around. And we went down to Moorhead, and I showed those guys the meeting. And they, on the way back, they nagged me the whole time. They said, you know, we got to start a meeting just like that. So we got up there, and I didn't want to start a meeting, you know. I thought, well, let's not get carried away, you know. So we ended up starting a meeting, and I remember there were like five of us to start out with. I was having a good time in my life. I was just having fun all over again, and all it was just a temporary period of uncertainty. That meeting started to take off, and I started to have a good time living in Minot, North Dakota. And I'm telling you, it's out in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing out there, and not one casino at all. But eventually, I remember I had to move on, and I got this bright idea. I decided I was going to do something else for a living. I called my sponsor, and I had this big plan. I was going to change careers and do something else. I ended up moving all over the place. I remember living in, moved back to Fargo, moved out to California, lived in Las Vegas for a while, lived out in Washington, D.C. for a while, and now I've planted in St. Charles, Missouri. Same thing happened when I got down there. I couldn't handle the way they did meetings down there because I like it exciting. I like it fun. I like to have fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. Otherwise, I'm not going to do it. We started a group down there, and it's going to take a while, but it's going to be a fun group, you know, and we're going to have a good time. And what's funny is, when I look back, you know, I mean, I've had a lot of fun in Alcoholics Anonymous, and obviously my brother's been a big part of my sobriety, too, because he sobered up before I did, and we've traveled all over and had a lot of good times. I remember when we sobered up, we were dirt poor. We used to hitchhike home from Moorhead, Minnesota, and my mom lived right off the interstate, so they'd drop us off there. We'd walk down, Merry Christmas, Mom, you know, pretty convenient. She lived right there, I didn't think things were going to change. I didn't think I was going to become an adult, you know. I thought I was going to live like that the rest of my life. But one time I remember my brother, I ended up going through basic training in the Air Force, and I remember my brother showed up there, and he went on to become an officer in the Marine Corps, and he showed up at my graduation, you know, and when my brother showed up, he was an officer, so I loved it, because when he walked in the dorm, they had to call the room to attention, and all those guys had been bad-mouthing me for all that time, giving me a hard time, they all had to stand at attention when my brother walked in the door, and I didn't stand at attention, no, he's my brother, you know, and we ended up both living in California, and he flew helicopters in the Marine Corps, and I was an instructor out there in Long Beach, California. And one day we met up out over the Pacific Ocean, and I was flying this little Cessna, and all of a sudden this big house pulls up next to me, and it was this huge helicopter, and it was my brother with VIPs on the back, you know. And I thought, if the FAA or the military ever knew what we had done, you know, I thought that would be the end of it, or if they just knew who they had up there, you know. It's funny now, we both work for the same company now, and I'm a captain, he's a first officer, so I'm looking forward to the opportunity to tell him what to do. My sobriety date was March 20th, 1983, and I was 17 years old. And, man, I mean to tell you, if all Alcoholics Anonymous was sitting around not drinking and being miserable, I wouldn't be here today. I'd have left a long time ago. I just refuse to be miserable, man. I want to live a good life, and I want to have fun, and that's what AA is all about. My sponsor told me, he says, Scott, he says, when I sobered up, he says, Scott, he says, you did your best thinking for 17 years, and you got nowhere. And he says, just give what we do a try. I can tell you by far, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. Thanks again for inviting me. It's good to be here.